Oh, hey, Kate.
Tell me about the teachings, the precious, precious teachings. Tell me about the scripture. Quit
This the start of your new rock opera about
God, bring me to God, show me the way. I'm in the dark, only you can show me the way. Ryan. Yeah, it is the start of my new rock opera. Oh, it's gonna be seen by dozens.
Dozens, half dozens,
It's gonna be
all over the
all
world.
related. Because I got a
Oh
free card to the 99 restaurant.
I can see it now.
Can you feel the great veil lifting, Ryan? Can you feel it?
Oh, no, I can't. I absolutely can't. So how's it going?
Fucking terrible.
And scene, end of
Yeah.
podcast. That's all you
No.
get, folks.
Look, here's the thing. It's great. It's great in its monstrosity. It's a beautiful, beautiful mess. But everything's a mess. Everything everywhere is a mess.
It's true.
And I'm really excited in my teaching. I'm excited, and I'm happy. My practice is fucking weird because there's some interesting things that are going on with my body, which I hope we can talk about. That'll be fun. My body. And then, there's some interesting, there's lots of interesting things happening, as there always are in the yoga world, during its death rattle.
Yes, I think we are approaching the death rattle. I do believe that that is the case.
It's like, oh, look what it coughed up.
Which, to be fair, is no different than what things more broadly have coughed up.
Oh, absolutely. There's tornadoes of fire. There's
Yeah.
tornadoes of fire in Australia.
Where shall we start then?
I don't know. Matt clips.
Yes, let's start with that. So
Wait, can we
as wait,
how
go
are you
ahead.
doing? You asked me, but
Oh,
now I have
sorry.
to ask, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, settling into this new life, of not having a studio to worry about. Of course, my workaholic self has replaced all of the stress of administrating a studio to just applying all of that to teaching yoga and doing body work, which is interesting, and certainly more enjoyable.
And
But
also paid. That's
yes,
exciting.
and also paid, which is the best part about it, is that I go to work and I teach, and then a paycheck lands in my bank account 2 weeks later, and that's pretty remarkable, I have to say.
Hallelujah.
in a word, yes. I started going to the gym this week.
I'm sorry, what? It sounded like you said something crazy.
Yeah, I haven't done that in a decade, I think, like since I've moved to Boston. It's interesting. I think it's just good to, I don't know.
So what brought it about?
The realization that if I am going to do, like, if I am going to do as much teaching and as much body work as I want to do, that there are some things in terms of sort of weightlifting that and like just sort of a general gym routine would be helpful for. 'Cause you take all of the you take all of the emphasis that goes on in yoga class in terms of certain movements, and then you add the sort of pushing into humans that goes on when you're doing body work, and it starts to wear a little bit. And if I can do just some very simple light stuff with weights and resistance bands, I don't feel that kind of wear and tear quite so acutely at the end of the week. So, that has been feeling good. It also is really helpful, like doing sort of more like typical cardio stuff, seems to be helpful on my hip. I walk everywhere, and that's helpful, but there is something about doing a little bit more than that, that seems to get the juices flowing. 'Cause I don't know if you remember, a couple years ago I fell pretty hard on my right hip, and like most of the time it's like 100% fine, and then every couple of months, it's like, "Hi, I'm still here. Please pay attention to me."
Yeah, please pay me mind.
So it's been interesting, and we'll see how long. And I use and I ha like when I wanted to quote unquote work out, which is a phrase that I hate. Historically, I would go to some form of class, like a spin class or a. Mostly spin, because other stuff I really can't stand. But I tried to do that a couple weeks ago, and I was like, God, this is fucking annoying. I just need to go somewhere where I can do what I need to do on my own and not have to deal with this person, like, shouting, platitudes and, self-help jargon while I'm pedaling my ass off on this bike. It's just not.
Oh, I like the self-help thing. Yeah, scream it at me. Scream it at me all day long
Oh, yeah,
while I'm walking down the street. You're stronger than you know.
yeah, no, it's not gonna work for me. So yeah, it's interesting though. Friends have been throwing a lot of shade because I don't think they ever pictured me ever joining a gym ever. Yeah, we'll see how long it lasts. It's triggering as fuck to be in there, I have to say. Like,
Can I ask what gym?
the BSE. Like the whole like I mean, even just like that, there's like a men's locker room that I have to go into is just like, oh my, I was just like. I like saw someone that I knew at the gym yesterday, and I like totally just like blew right past him, and I didn't even notice. And then he like texted me later and was like, "Are you okay? I saw you at the gym and waved hi, and you just kind of like ignored me." I was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm just. I have to just get in there, do what I need to do, and get out. Next time I will say hi, I promise. Like, I'm sorry that I blew you off there." But for right now, it's the right price, and I can't really afford anything fancier. So I'll work with what I got, and I will have to say, also, just like I'm exhausted at the end of the day when I add that into my routine, but I like generally just feel better mentally and emotionally,
Then you
which
gotta
I
do it.
hate to admit,
I know.
but
I get it.
Yeah. So there you have it. That's that's where. Is there anything else? No, I think that's pretty much. Oh, the other thing I was going to tell you is that I, you know, I still live right behind Bow Street, so, and it totally fine. But I saw them doing construction in the space, yesterday when I left my apartment, and I was just like gutted for a moment. I was like, oh no. So, you know,
yeah, every day. Yeah, that's got to be hard. It's like right there.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not like, it doesn't like wear on me all day, but like every time I walk by and I see people doing work in there, I'm just like, oof. Ugh. Maybe I'll have to move at some point.
I do think you do. Yeah.
Well,
or well, you just won't care as much once it's like a, what's it going to be? Housing?
What do you mean?
What are they going to change the space into?
Right now, it just looks like they're painting, which tells me, and like doing some stuff on the floor, which tells me that they probably aren't going to change it over into residential yet. He might just be trying to make it look nice before putting it on the up for rent again. But I don't really know. So
I am in the process of watching somebody's practice on Instagram.
Okay.
And I'm done with it as a marketing tool.
Instagram? Or just the putting your practice up on Instagram?
Yeah, like come flow with me. We'll do this kind of thing. And now watch me do it in my house. This is what it looks like.
Yeah.
It is so fucking narcissistic and self-serving. I'm sorry. What the hell does it? And we still do it. Like, I'm done. Look at my performance art. Look at me dance. That's what it is. Look at my slow, porny yoga dance. Now come to my class and give me some money.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, it is the world that we operate in. I mean, it is. It is the world that we operate in. It's like,
it's so fucking, like, resonated a different pitch for the love of God. Come on. I'm so fucking bored. And it's just disappointing. I feel like I'm like this old drunk aunt that's like walking around like, you little shits. When I was your age, we were fucking cool doing acid in the field or whatever, you know. And anyways, yeah, so I'm just get over it, Kate, get over it, because that's what they're going to do, because that's what people do, because there is literal lack of imagination in the planet, and people do not think for a second that they're causing harm when they are, and they don't care, because yoga teachers are just as dumb and hateful as the rest of the world. Everybody is dumb and hateful. We just sell ourselves as like this fucking like bastion of positivity when we're just as insidiously cruel and toxic and poisonous as humans. But we're even worse because we pretend not to be. We pretend to like float above it with fucking yogi tea bags. Look at this. I should go home. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be here. Did I say any of this out loud?
Yes, you did. But you know, you're not wrong.
And if you're listening right now and you're like, oh my God, is she talking about me? I probably am. No, I don't know. I don't know who you are. I'm allowed to express rage. I have a little bit of a platform for my rage. And there's a couple other people out there that do too. I'm not the only one that's doing this, so I'm not going to feel shame.
Yeah. But I do think that you know, it even seeps into be it's I've had a number of instances in the past couple of weeks where that sort of faux positivity also lends itself to thinking that the actual practice of yoga therefore sort of causes that positivity to arise, and having to tell people that, like, well, it in some moments it might be able to soften your rage. In some moments, it might rev that rage right back up again. And really, like, the only constant is, like, if I'm gonna practice, like, yes, there might be some quieting and some ease that comes, but then right underneath the surface, there's all that shit still there. And it's just, you know, especially when people talk about, like, meditation as a therapeutic device, it's just like, eek, well, maybe we should talk about that a little bit, because if someone's having some acute shit going on emotionally, intellectually, and they've never meditated before, I don't necessarily want them to get a lesson on Buddhist meditation. That's not going to be helpful.
Exactly.
It's
Yep.
just probably not. I mean, maybe for some human being somewhere, yes, but not.
No, yeah, it is not. It just from personal experience in early sobriety when or when I was closer to the I if it was terrible. Like meditation was absolutely it's a joy now. But I mean, you even remember. I remember even coming in to take a class. I wanted to pull the skin off my face. It wasn't appropriate. It wasn't appropriate. It wasn't appropriate. And it wasn't because I remember feeling shame about that too. Like, oh my God, I can't even meditate. Like, I'm so fucked up. I can't meditate. And that wasn't the case. It's just when you're in the middle of an acute response to trauma, or you're in the early phases of recovery, or any other number of things that would make you predisposed to have increased fight or flight response to meditation, then self-flagellating and forcing yourself into something, because people that don't understand the the neurochemical response to this type of thing have told you it's a good heal all. Yeah, it's not great.
How did we get there? Oh, positivity. I am finding it an interesting. I mean, you just get up in front of the class and say whatever the fuck you want. I kind of wish that I had that impetus. But it is, you know,
How come you don't? Don't you?
most of the time, but it is, you know, a little more filtered, especially teaching at a bigger studio now. And then there's always that sort of fine line of, like, the sort of shifting purpose of what a drop-in yoga class is for. Wherein,
Absolutely.
you know, it's not necessarily a classroom in which people are learning discrete skills and techniques anymore. It's the place where people are trying to have a practice. And so where I might say a lot more, I find myself holding back a little bit and trying to just be like, okay, just like in this 75 minutes, like, don't think you can deliver anything more than just a positive experience. And then if people have the curiosity, just make sure that there is a venue in which they can if the thought comes up, what the fuck are we doing? How is this working? Why is this working? Where people can access that information as well.
Yes.
Making sure that the route to learning that information is not necessarily couched in teacher training. That it is couched in longer form classes, in longer form workshops, in longer form series, and then in individual interaction. And that's really tricky because I do want to embed the actual stuff that I'm trying to teach into those experiences of 75-minute practices and just not be quite as explicit, not be quite as detail-oriented about the minutia of it, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. It makes total sense. That's always kind of my goal is most of the class, I assume, you know, is for people to have a practice. And then if there's like one moment per class where I unpack something or talk in more detail about, you know, something more structural or functional or what the somatic intention is. Yeah, I try to do that. Once a class, so it's not all about the experience of the practice, but there is like a takeaway so that if they do happen to have a home practice or they are thinking, you know, about teacher training, there's like a nugget from each class, but I don't know. I just feel like the world's on fire.
It quite literally is. How has your, experience of the little, actually, since people may not have listened to previous episodes, would you like to explain the system of mat clippings, mat clips, snap, mat snap, clippy, clothespinny situations that we have going on at our shared place of employment?
Yeah, so Down Under, the studio that we teach at, has chosen to have across the board a way to communicate on the schedule what to expect in terms of the potential offering of hands-on assists and adjusts. And part of that is when you look at the class schedule, you can tell if that's even going to be offered. And if it is offered, once you're actually physically in the classroom, you're presented with a basket of mat clips. If you are open, interested, and welcoming to hands-on assists, you put a clip on your mat. Otherwise, the assumption is, leave me be physically. There's also a list of protocols for the teachers that talk about what's acceptable and what's not. And I'm really proud of, you know, the imperfect but work that the studio is doing to change the culture around this. I think is great. It's forcing conversations that we should have been having, you know, a fucking decade ago, but here we are. Anyways, so I have really been enjoying just starting each of, you know, most of the classes I teach now, just sort of like with talking to students about it. Like, hey, this is what you're seeing in the studio. This is why it's here. This is what we're doing. And I, you know, I've just have an over it. The response has just been like overwhelmingly positive. Like people like being involved in the conversation.
Yes, I think that's right. I think people do like being involved in the conversation. And
as they always should have been.
And I do think that it's a great first step. I do think that it is a great first step. It has been interesting to me to I kind of thought that it might create sort of the unrealistic expectation that, you know, if I have a clothespin on my mat, that I absolutely will be touched. And
I
I don't see
I've
that
heard that from
happening.
other people.
And I
That's
don't
not a
see that
thing.
happening. I don't see people fussed if they don't get a hands-on attention. And the other thing that's been really interesting, and actually I've had to have more conversations with fellow teachers about this than students necessarily, is people are constantly asking, well, not constantly, people, a number of the other teachers have commented on, well, I really think that it should be the other way around. Meaning that the
Who,
mat clip
no,
goes,
nobody's actually saying
yes,
that.
Yes.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are. And I say two.
I literally am three times the size I was 2 seconds ago.
Yeah. I say two things to them. One of which is, you know, we're trying to foster affirmative consent. So in that way, it would not make any sense to have the clip on if you're saying, don't touch me. It's like, I am open to hands-on assist by putting this clip on the mat, is like layer one of consent. And then layer two of consent is being walking up to the person, seeing the mat clip and saying, can I adjust you in this way, in this pose? You know, obviously if I, you know, more specific when they're actually in a pose in front of you and you can describe what you're about to do. And they say, usually, if the clip is there, yes, please. And then you assist and then you move on with your day. The other thing that I tell them is that I had an experience of taking someone else's class and they, right before class started, sort of like held up the basket of clips and said, okay, so these are the new, you know, explain the new policies. If you're open to hands-on assist, please take one of these. And there was a moment where I was sitting there like, you know, do I want to go grab that? Do I not want to go grab that? And then it occurred to me as everyone like ran up to the front of the room to get a clip, I was like, oh, how awkward would it have been if I was like the only person in this, or the four or five people in this 40 person class who did not want to be touched, had to like awkwardly walk up to the front of the room and grab a clip.
Grab your clip.
And go on.
Let everyone know.
As opposed to just sitting on my mat where I was and just opting out of getting the clip. And in the context of that class, I did end up going up there and grabbing the clip. But in another class, although to be honest, I have to say, if I'm going to a class and like absent some, just me being in a foul mood and not wanting anyone to pay attention to me, I'm not going to go to a class where I wouldn't feel comfortable putting the clip on the mat.
Oh, I do.
Generally. I'm not, there's nobody's class that I would go to where I'm like, okay, I don't trust this person enough to, you know, generally assist me. Though there may be days where I'm just like, leave me the fuck alone, that I might not put it on. You know, does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Because I don't really go to that many public classes to begin with.
For that to be a thing.
Yeah. But I do see people, though, even in the classes where the schedule does not indicate that there are hands-on assists being given, people still grabbing the clips and putting them on the mat. And I think part of that is just because there are so few classes where it is indicated that there won't be hands-on assists. So that's interesting, and we'll, you know, I do think it'll be something that in a year we'll have a much more evolved, well, not evolved, there will be an evolution of the policy, that'll be even better, And then the following year, an evolution of the policy that will be even better than that. You know what I mean? Like, it'll be something that is kind of constantly examined and discussed. And I think that that's wonderful. Because the conversation that I would really like to have amongst the faculty is, what is the value of touch in a yoga class? And
it's a big one.
Versus the value of, you know, I do think there's value to touch in terms of yoga instruction, but specifically in terms of a group drop-in yoga class, what is the value of touch? That is a conversation that I think is worth having. And the answer could and probably would be different from teacher to teacher, and especially in, you know, the various methods that are taught at the studio, it's different. It's also a very nuanced discussion. 'Cause it's not necessarily, you know, there are plenty of examples where a teacher might need to step in and, you know, prevent someone from, like, falling out of the ropes, or, you know, someone's, I don't know, there's any number of reasons why, like, in a moment, a teacher might end up making contact with a student. So I don't think it's quite as easy to say, like, nope, it's all over, we're not doing this anymore. I think more the value comes in actually having that discussion amongst the teachers. And I think that will evolve with just having this policy in place, because certainly, especially when I've subbed classes that have had the hand that have indicated that there would be hands-on adjustments, there were moments where I was like, oh, actually, this is a moment when a hands-on adjustment would actually be quite appropriate. And I did it.
And I went on ahead.
And I did it. But mostly, it's still a rare thing for me to use any sort of manual assistance in a group class, and probably always will be a rare thing.
Well, I'm just glad that there's a conversation. The thing that I've noticed is, you know, I'm one of the people on the schedule that doesn't offer.
I think you and I are the only people on the schedule, maybe, that doesn't. I could be wrong about that, but
really,
if you look at the schedule, one person. I would have to confirm that, but
so here's what's bullshit: is people teach like sometimes 5, 10, 15 classes a week. You can't pick out one of your 10 classes where you don't do it. You're so like, for me, why am I so angry? okay, let me just, I'm aware of the vitriol with which I spit, but just hear me out for a second. A teacher can't be like, you know what? This one class that I offer, I'm just going to have this be a hands-off class. You can't do that for the benefit of your fucking students. Your touch is so fucking healing that you've got to do it every fucking class. What a lack of imagination.
I don't know.
There's no.
I don't know about that. I think, you know,
these are people that did not go through massage therapy training, Ryan.
Okay.
They just want to get up there and rub a sweaty child's pose. That's what this is. I just want to press down on some hips, because then my students like me more. I feel connected. That's what this is. Am I gonna get fired?
Probably.
Then put it on the schedule. Pick a class and own it.
Yeah. I don't
Wait, why
know.
do I care? Why do I care?
That is all. Do you need me here for this
Yeah, I do. I need you to disagree so I can yell.
I mean, I think teachers are you know, they're allowed to do whatever they want. I do think it's worth I do think it's something worth examining. And
No. My touch is so important. It's so important that I touch every class I teach every week, that I cannot have it on the schedule once that I don't do that. Maybe it's not clear that you can choose which classes you'll offer it for. Like, if I taught more classes, let me be clear. So if I was teaching 10 classes a week, I would probably have two on the schedule where there'd be the little hand that, like, hands-on is offered. Maybe.
Yeah.
Like, I could imagine a world where it's like, look, for these classes I do, for these I don't, because I want to offer a range.
Yeah. I'm actually trying to look at the...
Are you looking?
I'm looking. I don't know. I there's certainly more a more classes on the schedule that indicate hands-on assist than don't. And to me, like, the difficult thing about that sort of on or off type of thing is that there is a wide variety of hands-on assistance that a teacher could provide. And I'm, you know, I just, I don't really know that the, like, on-off approach, in the long run is the solution. I think the dynamic with the clothespins on the mat is a nice dynamic in the classroom. So I think we'll just see how it evolves and how it moves forward and all that jazz, as it were.
And all that jazz. Yeah. Okay.
So tell me about the teachings, Kate.
Okay. So do you want me to pivot into what made me feel things about that word?
Well, can tell me your
'Cause
feelings
it's bigger.
About that. Tell me your feelings about that word first, maybe.
The teachings. Okay. So when we employ terms like the teachings, it is really important to me that we are more specific. Do not assume that people understand what texts you're talking about, what oral tradition you're referring to. I think we hide behind the teachings. And this is not unique to yoga.
No,
this
not at all.
Is something that is pretty much unique to folks talking about anything non-scientific in history. So this is the intersection of intertextuality, where we talk about where literature bifurcates right down the middle, religiosity and testament, and all of it is deeply suspect. So I think that's sort of how I just want to set the background, where the Bible as literature, the Vedas as literature, they are literature. This is historical documents. And we, in the yoga community, use the word teachings to elevate and to mystify things that are often not mysteries. You know, people use it as just this, like, waving of a wand term of like, yeah, but that's the teachings. Can we separate the teacher from the teachings?
Mm-hmm.
And what I would much prefer is a conversation about the teacher and the teachings.
Yes.
And what do you mean by the teachings? The teachings. What do you mean? Is this the scripture of behavior? What are we talking about? Like, it's too ambiguous.
Yeah, I agree. Because the teachings could just literally be the things that a person has taught. The teachings could be a scriptural pointing, like the quote-unquote teachings that come out of the Vedas or Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, or, you know, it could be very, very specific to that. But then, you know, even when you look at the textual sort of leaning of that word, then we also have to be clear of, like, are the teachings what that text meant in the historical context in which it was written, as best we can understand it, or is it the weird Rube Goldberg straw of telephone that landed in your yoga class when your teacher offered some conversation about yoga as the stillings of the patterns of consciousness. And, you know, I am all for being clear about where what we're teaching is coming from, and then where the people that we learned it from, like, who taught them. And so there can be a clear sense of, you know, eventually, okay, why might there be these biases embedded in the teachings? Well, it makes sense if, you know, everybody who taught these teachings, for the most part, were men. Or, you know, like, there's a way to then be critical about what the teachings actually mean, and then how we might choose to apply them if a person even finds them applicable to their practice and their sort of everyday experience. That was a mouthful. Did that make any sense?
Total sense, yes. It's stichomancy.
Whoa. Stichomancy. You want to give me a... I don't know that word.
It's a form of divination where somebody who's doing a reading pulls a line from a text.
Do you want to spell that for me?
Stichomancy.
Okay. Keep going. I'm intrigued.
So it's when you pull a line from a text, you like flip through a book and just pull a line, and then you pull meaning from it.
Gotcha.
That
okay.
That is, you know, not necessarily connected to the text from which it's been pulled.
Sure.
but it's a form of divination. And, you know, that's what we tend to do when yoga teachers are like, let me just pull this quote and slap it on Instagram. But I also just think that there's, you know, the idea that teachings are a fixed thing. I always return to the Catholic Church, and, you know, the teachings of the Catholic Church are as follows. So how can I get uncomfortable when people talk about the teachings and adhere to the teachings when language is so deeply fluid and interpretations, it becomes even more and more and more suspect when we look at who is doing translations, and how texts have been handed down from teacher to teacher, from translation to translation. So I actually am like not all that interested in anybody that talks about teachings as being a fixed thing.
Sure, but certainly there are, you know, I would include within teachings, like, techniques. Like how one teaches the technique
might
be fluid, but the technique is pretty.
But that's not what we mean when we say the teachings. So yes, I totally agree with you. The techniques, a thing I have been taught is different than teachings. I'm just saying from a linguistic perspective, the word teachings carries with it a dog whistle of something.
Sure. I absolutely agree with that.
Ineffably, yeah. Like almost holy.
Yes.
Something that supersedes man and language. The teachings carries something heavier than the technique. You know, the technique is humble. I like that. You know, if somebody were referring to what they've learned from another person and they were like, you know, the techniques I learned from practicing with Ryan were the following.
Yes.
That I get. I can wrap my head around that. That feels honest. Whereas if I say the teachings that Ryan has handed me feel very different.
Sure. Sure.
Anyways, I bring this up because there's a lot of talk about separating a teacher from the teachings. And the reason that comes up is because we have, you know, yet another larger name yoga teacher, Mark Whitwell, who's a total dirtbag. And here we are trying now to parse out who he is from his quote unquote teachings. And, you know, let's talk about his techniques. You know, separate his techniques from his douchebaggery. But let's not pretend that there are special, holy, ineffable teachings.
Sure.
That he alone has passed down from some unsubstantiated, transubstantiated fucking godmouth.
Sure. I mean, I also think there's a way in which we, like, when people say that phrase, can you, I guess it is phrased both ways sometimes.
Or do we
separate the teachings from the teacher? The thing that I think is often what people are saying is, can you cope with the fact that you received or were helped by this person and they did something awful to another person? Can you hold both of those truths in your mind at the same time? And does that truth that you now know, that this person behaved awfully towards probably more women than we know currently at this moment in history, can you hold the fact that, yeah, encountering this human being at a certain point in my life was really helpful, and the shit went down that's not great? And like, yes, that's a hard thing to hold. It's a really hard thing to hold. And I do think that there are times where you can actually have a legit conversation about separating teachings from teacher. I do think when there is something like the kind of canon of Buddhist teachings, and then there is a Buddhist teacher who behaves poorly, this is coming from very personal experience, that I can say, okay, yeah, I always kind of had my suspicions about what the fuck was going on here. But it doesn't mean that the Buddhist teachings, which did not originate with this person in any way, shape, or form, don't have some meaning to me, nor does it mean that I'm not going to take that new information about not only a specific Buddhist teacher, but now many, many, many Buddhist teachers who have, you know, sort of abused their power and look somewhat suspiciously at the teachings, or maybe not suspiciously, but critically at the teachings to see, you know,
teachings.
If it were. But that, you know, there is a canon of, what would you rather say, sort of commentary, the canon of, because I think the thing in the yoga community that's interesting is people are just pulling teachings out of their fucking asses.
Stichomancy.
Without, you know, a clear sense of where they are tracking them from, with the exception of people who, for whatever reason, were, certainly there are people like Mark who claim that the teachings came from Krishnamacharya, but you trace that back and you realize that, like, that's not really a clear line of...
Yeah, and he also used that to rationalize some
really
violent sex stuff, you know, or some inappropriate, you know, Krishnamacharya is coming through his freaking orgasms. Like, great. You know, okay, so one of the analogies I think of is Brett Kavanaugh.
Okay.
Do I now want to throw away all of American law because Brett Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court?
Sure.
No, but do I want to question a lot of the things?
Yes.
Yeah. And do I question the thing that people like him are drawn to about it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it question the fundamental underpinnings of what we're doing? Hell yeah. So yeah, I do question the teachings. Because if it has enabled someone like that to come through under the auspices of the teachings that he has shared with his students and a series of people that have aided and abetted and just sort of like allowed it to happen with like a like, yeah, no, 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 it's okay. He's a predator, but he's a great teacher. Like, yeah, 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 it's okay. He's a predator, but he's, you know, he's the Supreme, you know, he's on the Supreme Court. Like, it's just the time's up, you know, like I'm done. I personally, I just want to hear from more voices of people that haven't been heard from. And that tends not to be right now white male yoga teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I also don't want to hear from like 28-year-old white yoga teachers. Like I want to be fair. But I do think that we should question the quote unquote teachings, which means diving deeper into what we can dive deeper into. Where are they from? What are we actually referencing? What is the context with which they were written historically? Mm-hmm. What are we doing? You know,
well, I don't think
most people can actually answer any of those questions.
Well, precisely. I understand the sort of dog whistle that occurs with that word teachings, but I think the reason why I don't throw that word out the window completely is because to me, my engagement with anything that I would call teachings has been this sort of like, well, where the fuck does this come from? And like, is it of any use? And like oftentimes it isn't of any use, and then there comes a point where shit hits the fan and I'm like, oh, that thing, that list or that idea or that book or that, you know, that's actually kind of interesting in this context. And like that type of engagement with quote unquote teachings is much more practical and pragmatic and so I don't necessarily find that phrase to describe of understanding or work or techniques or what have you to be inherently problematic. It's just the sort of like when it's used as the sort of vague like
the teachings
way to insert some sense of what's the word I'm looking for, some semblance of depth.
Yes, it's often weaponized. I think that's what I'm responding to. Is let's look at the case of, or not the case of, let's look at a scenario in which we have like a young a new yoga student who is, you know, transfixed by a really charismatic yoga teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And they are throwing around things about teachings without this, you know, pupil of theirs having access to what they're actually referring to in terms of the teachings. There is like a, you will get exposed to the teachings in a controlled drip that is part of the manipulation of that infected power dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is where I get like, no, this is all like public domain here. the transmission of teachings. I think it's suspect to have something that has to go through the filter of a fucking man in that particular way.
Sure, sure. And I mean, and while that is often weaponized, there is also the truth that there is such a thing as transmission. You know, there I fully have experienced, and you know, not, and it's not this sort of like Shaktipat, someone taps you on the forehead type of situation. There certainly is an energetic quality to it, but there is something about being, and I can explain it very, you know, and yes, there are aspects of this that can be weaponized and can be turned into sort of cult-like qualities, but when you are talking about not like how to do Trikonasana here, this is not what I'm talking about. when you're talking about something having to do with sort of the nature of mind or the nature of spirit or what have you, and you are able to take the time to sort of quiet and not be so caught up in the sort of like day-to-day like running around struggle of life, and you get to discuss and contemplate and argue with a teacher about a certain text or a certain idea or a certain quality or a certain meditation technique or a certain, that there is a transmission there that is different than being in a 40 person yoga class just after work where, you know, you've got to get to dinner afterwards. You know, it there's just a different quality to it. And so when I say transmission, I actually really want to like take the kind of like mysticism out of that. And it's just, there is a quality of learning that can happen that is the transmission. It kind of like imprints experience a little bit differently. The tricky thing about this sort of like, I don't know how much of that was got, but what I was saying was that the trickiness of all of this bullshit that we're dealing with in terms of people that have sort of abused, insert religion or philosophy here, is how do we hold the fact that there was some benefit, there was some intelligence there, and bring that into a modern context without doing a, you know, without just turning it into sort of like a pure capitalistic manipulation of the teachings. Because that's the other thing that can happen, is just pure like, now you got to give me more money for teachings. Or now you got to buy the teachings, or now you got to consume the teachings.
All right, now you got to bang me for the teachings.
Yes, and it gets to the same place eventually.
Can you?
So figuring out how to hold some of the, you know, specifically when I think about Buddhism and yoga to hold the sort of potential richness of that without the sort of potential for manipulation that comes from having some sort of hierarchy or some sort of pedagogy to the situation. And some of that I do think will be what's the word I'm looking for? A democratization is coming to mind, but that's not quite what I'm looking for. That things will become more open sourced, if that makes sense.
Yay!
But
Yes,
that's
I like
not
that
just because
phrase.
things become more open source doesn't that can lead to its own trickiness, because then people can take things, because that can lead to a heck of a lot of spiritual bypassing, in which people take teachings that were meant to be describing a sort of ultimate nature, ultimate state of reality, ultimate state of yoga, and try to apply them to everyday situations that these texts could never have dreamed of. Because they did not exist, the people who wrote and thought about these texts did not exist in our current modern state. So, like we that therein lies the trickiness, if that makes any cognitive sense.
Makes perfect sense. I struggle as a person that has as a survivor of complex trauma. I struggle. I sometimes just wish it was okay to not be friends anymore with people that cause harm like that. You know, I'm trying so hard to be fair, and my anger rises up in place of a deep sadness. So I honor my anger because it's there to prevent me from, you know, collapsing into a cave of being just deeply sad. Anger feels more productive to me. But I think that it's really, really hard to speak out when something has happened to you, when something continues to happen to you, because people don't believe you, and or people question you, or
Absolutely.
they call you broken or damaged, or you did something. Like, it's just the way it is. We always protect the people. We protect the abusers. We apologize for them. We look at their humanity, and of course they have humanity, but in doing so, in the quiet and chronic apologies for them, what we do is erode the value of the person that has sustained the injury, and they will spend, you know, the rest of their lives doing the work they need to do to wake up in the morning and feel okay. And we're a lot less concerned with them than we are with the person's career that so I find it hard to be friends with someone that I know is capable. You know, it's so hard. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people lately where it's like, yeah, but we can't just go on witch hunts. You know, and even that term is amazing because in the witch hunts, it was like, oh, we just took ladies and burned them. It was the women. We just fucking silenced them. So there's just, we have this ancient history of silencing women, and in the name of a man in authority, in the name, you know, we are not to be believed. We are broken lunatics, heretics, you know, and I'm angry, and I'm disinterested in preserving the wellness of somebody that has harmed somebody with less power.
And And I also just think that we don't really know how to respond well when these type of abuses become public. And I mean respond well on both ends, because it's the whiplash of people who are wanting and willing to defend and look at the abuser's humanity, which is then only fueled by people calling out the people. Like, there's the need for immediate reaction and response, often in the form of Facebook posts, I think sidesteps the, like, actually just sitting there and being like that article that Christy Rowe wrote about Mark, that was really hard to read. I mean, I had to stop a couple of times because it was, and I don't even know what I mean by hard to read. It was just like,
I read it and it was like every sentence for me was like,
yeah,
oh my God, this 100% happened. The,
yeah,
her bravery in detail.
The detail was quite, yes.
What her writing, her exquisite writing is what, for me, is, it's very difficult to do, but also, like, it's just unimpeachable. Like, that is exactly how it happens. It is full of gray areas, and her willingness to take, you know, self-reflection and responsibility for the places where she made choices, and like, it's just so hard to do. And she did an absolutely brave, valiant, and articulate job of doing the near impossible.
Yes. And what then I saw was people's commentary on it, and I just wanted to be like just let yourself sit with that for a bit. Like, Jesus Christ, like that, like that very much speaks for itself. And to, like, I just wonder if this, like, cycle of like, hello? people could have just posted that and, like, let the commentary be, and just amplified her voice instead of making it about whatever they made it about. And I saw a lot of interesting commentary on this one on both sides of the fence that I was just like, this doesn't just amplify what she wrote, because it is worth everybody reading. And it just doesn't need putting your baggage or your hatred of Mark on top of what she had to say. Does not in fact honor the words that she wrote.
I didn't see this. I gotta go through and look.
Yeah. Like, that just refocuses it. Especially if, like, it would be different if someone was saying, like, I had a similar experience, but these were not people who were saying they had similar experience. These were just the people who like to comment on the yoga world more generally. I think that, it just becomes this endless array of, like, commentary that happens at such a quick pace nowadays that it's just like, because then it becomes, okay, so then it becomes about Matthew, what Matthew Remsky and people like that think about the whole ordeal. And then it becomes about what Jay thinks about the whole ordeal. And then it becomes what Matthew and Karen and all of these other people think about what Jay thinks about the whole ordeal. And it's like, okay, we have drifted.
Yeah.
You have inevitably made it about a different white man now. Like, that's what you've done. You've taken this person's, like, difficult situation and you've, like,
made it about someone else. Yep, that's so true.
And I'm just like, so it's no. Like,
but that's human nature, is to be so angry about the harm from one person that you also look to the surrounding. I mean, but we should do that, though, shouldn't we? I don't know. Okay, so two thoughts. One is, stay focused and keep your anger directed where it belongs.
Sure.
But also, anger never really belongs pointed at just one thing, because nothing is in a vacuum. We have to look at the surrounding, like, environment that enables this kind of thing. So yeah, we do have to pivot the cannons, but we allow for a moment of just focusing our searing hot rage at one place.
But pivoting the cannons is not commenting on the comments on the commentary on the like, that's not really shifting the cannons in my book. Shifting the cannons would be, okay, I don't know what that looks like, but Facebook is not the place where one shifts cannons. That's my whole thing. Like, if we're really going to do, if people really felt called to act, a Facebook comment and post here or there, I just don't think that is a call to action.
I think it is, because this is the milieu with which we live, so it's all we have. I'm not going to, like, get in my car, you know, and drive.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're still so in the dark about how to take in this information and process it and then decide what is worth saying and what is worth doing. Other than to say, like, you know, a really, like, concrete action is if, like, I don't know that he still tours anymore, but if you read that and saw that there was a local studio that you know that was hosting him, to just
go picket it.
Go give it, not even that, just, like, give the studio owner a call and be like, I think you should reconsider this. And here's why.
We got a dirty birdie coming in on left field. Dirty birdie at 3 o'clock. This has been unrolled.
This is... Oh my god, has it. I feel like there was another thing you wanted to talk about in our endless list of nonsensical text messages.
Yeah, I need you to edit some things out, too.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Like, the whole podcast, or...
Yeah, let's just have this one for the private files.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a strange world we live in. It's a very strange world we live in.
Yeah, and it's a particularly strange world with which we practice yoga in.
That is very true. That is very true. And, you know, there's not a day that goes by that I'm, especially now that I'm just teaching, that I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I really don't. I don't know.
Yeah. And that's the only answer that I can come up with is like, I don't know. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
All right, yeah, we have some other topics. We'll get to them next week.
For sure, for sure. Okay.
Stay angry.
Yeah, sure.
Bye.
Bye.